This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
I attended the argument. The justices were marvelously attentive, and I think the simple, direct, and powerful 9-0 decision indicates that they believe the genome is something that is important to be, if you will, not using it in the legal sense, but free. And it will make a difference, I believe, both in terms of availability for those who want the tests and also in terms of research. So my view of it is that it is quite an important. Well, I know it's an important.
Judge Robert Sweet, we're going to have to leave
decision.
It. We're going to have to leave it there. And I thank you so much for being with us. Also, I know your clerks just got together and celebrated your 90th birthday. Happy birthday, Judge Robert Sweet. Also, thanks so much to Sandra Park and Lizbeth Siriani. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland appearance of David K. Johnston, author of the book, The Rise of Monopolists, Why the Few Get Rich While Your Paycheck Shrinks. The book explains how the already very rich have for three decades quietly earned huge profits with help from politicians. David K. Johnston will be speaking at the First Unitarian Church on Friday, June 14th at 7 p.m. about the devastating economic stories unfolding in the public record that major media do not cover. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Peace, this is Mike Crenshaw. I want to invite you to come out to see Long Distance Revolutionary, a documentary about Mumia Abu-Jamal. This film chronicles his life as a revolutionary, a writer, a journalist, a philosopher, and an inspiration to people worldwide. It's showing June 14th at the Clinton Street Theater. That's a Friday night.
At 7 p.m.
That starts the week-long run of Long Distance Revolutionary in Portland. KBOO is proud to bring you this event, and I hope to see you there.
The time is now 5:02, and you're tuned into KBOO Portland FM. And coming up next is the evening news, and the KBOO evening news is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. Coming up, KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an exclusive interview with the Oregon ACLU about a bill passed this week by the state legislature allowing red light cameras to be used to track suspects of other crimes.
Workers from the Fund for the Public Interest walked off the job this afternoon and into the KBOO studios to tell us their story about their struggle for fair treatment.
And representatives of the Center for Intercultural Organizing prepare to go to Salem to support a bill that will try to end racial, ethnic, and other types of profiling by law enforcement in the state.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 14th, 2013. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Liam Delta. Federal contractors continued unnecessary construction work for an entire year at Hanford Nuclear Site, despite clear evidence of nuclear contamination. Washington River Protection Group, WRPG, has been working to contain nuclear waste at Hanford in 28 underground containers. One of the tanks, AY-102, was found to be leaking as early as 2011, but the WRPG continued to spend over $14 million on construction work until the project was finally brought to a halt in 2012. AY-102 is filled with extremely radioactive chemicals and is considered the most toxic of all holding tanks at Hanford. If the container had continued to be used as intended, the tank's nuclear waste would have eventually spread to the outside environment. According to instrument technician Mike Geoffrey, WRPG contractors were aware that they should have changed their construction plans and that the past year's work accomplished little apart from spending taxpayers' money. The Hanford nuclear site suffered deep cuts from the federal sequester, resulting in employee layoffs and furlough days.
This afternoon, employees with the Portland Telephone Outreach Project of the Fund for Public Interest walked out of labor contract negotiations. I spoke with the strikers for more on this story.
We have been in contract negotiations with the fund for about 2 years now, and we just walked out today on a ULP strike in response to the fund firing the 8th contract negotiator that they fired so far. So we're actually really super near having an actual contractual agreement with the fund. We TA'd a complete contract at the last negotiations, but the contract that the fund then gave us to vote on and sign didn't actually match up with the contract that we had TA'd. So we're in this kind of limbo phase where the actual language for the contract is being hashed out. And in the meantime, two veteran callers, John and now James, have both been fired for policies that would be different under the contract if it got signed. So we're really frustrated and disappointed that the fund can't just actually implement the policies that they've agreed to allow these guys to keep their jobs. They've been good callers for years, and all of a sudden they're being let go.
When were they fired?
So John was fired last week on Thursday. James was fired last night. Thursday is the day that people get let go for missing quota.
My name's Hillary. I've been with the Fund for the Public Interest for about a year and a half. I've sat next to James, the former employee, as of yesterday, for that entire year and a half. In that year and a half, James has been a strong caller, very consistent. I think he's maybe been on ultimatum once or twice in that time. And in the last 3 weeks, James has been on ultimatum twice. First time it was very close getting off it. And then, as we've said before, last night he didn't make it. He's one of the last bargaining units, original bargaining units, and he's also one of the last people who did walk off on the boss with the original walk off. And it just feels like these people are being targeted. We're not getting the fairness and consistency that the fund continues to claim that they give us.
Did you predict that you would be going on strike today, or was this inspired in the moment?
Well, so we've walked out in response to union negotiators being fired essentially every time that they have. So this isn't a humongous surprise. We did ask the fund this morning, you've started implementing policies from the new contract already. There is a policy that would mean that James would still have a job next week. How about you just implement that policy starting with him? They refused to do that, which isn't a humongous surprise. You know, we gave them the offer. We asked them politely to go ahead and help us out, but they refused to do that, and so everybody walked out.
I've worked for the Fund for the Public Interest on and off for 13 years, starting in 2000 in Minneapolis, and I've worked in Portland for the fund, both canvassing and doing the telephone outreach project. I directed a canvass office in Minneapolis. I've been working for the fund for a long time because I've always believed that these are good people, and I still believe that, which makes it exceptionally poignant and disappointing that the situation has come to this. It dawned on me yesterday that this is my resume. I have 13 years of Fund for the Public Interest on my resume. These are the people that I've worked for. And now I shudder to think of my next job interview if I'm asked, so tell us about your previous employer. Because like I said, I still believe that they're good people, but other good people got fired because they played bait and switch. They brought a contract, and to be clear, in the years that I've been working for the Fund for the Public Interest, I've been an employee who asked for these things that the union is asking for, but I haven't been one of the big wheels with the union. I didn't start the drive. I've always supported their efforts because year after year in the telephone outreach project, people have asked for health insurance, and they gave us health insurance that not many people can afford. We've asked for something as simple as direct deposit, and the story they gave us, it was always, it didn't jive with reality. We signed people, I mean, these callers sign up people every day to give monthly through their checking account or credit card, and yet the fund says they can't even set up direct deposit. They'll tell us that if you are sick, please don't come into work, and yet every time they've ever told us that, whether I was a caller or my current capacity is just an administrative assistant, I've said, well, if you don't want people to come in sick, pay them to not come in sick. Time and time again, we've asked for these seemingly simple things. And I'm standing in solidarity with my coworkers today saying we're not going away.
That was Vernon Walkland, Hillary Price, and Carl Mankey, three striking employees of the Portland Telephone Outreach Project of the Fund for the Public Interest. I'm Ren Green for KBOO News.
U.S. Senator for Oregon Jeff Merkley has launched a pilot program that is supposed to help underwater homeowners in Oregon. Homeowners are considered underwater when they owe more than their home is worth. Currently, 132,000 homeowners in Oregon are underwater in their mortgages. The pilot program launched by Merkley will help just 50 of these homeowners. Leading housing advocate Carrie Coe to say that this is just the latest in a series of Band-Aid solutions that do not address the root of the housing crisis in Oregon.
First of all, it's for folks who are underwater but haven't ever missed a payment, which is a pretty rare occurrence. Secondly, it's for people who are unemployed and receiving unemployment insurance or qualifying for the unemployment program. And there's a series of other points within this piece of legislation that essentially eliminate people from being able to utilize the program. So it feels like it's an effort, and we recognize that, and we're hopeful that some homeowners will be able to find relief from these crushing mortgages. But this legislation simply doesn't go far enough, and it's misguided in the sense that what we really need to be talking about is principal reduction for these underwater mortgages.
That was local housing activist Carrie Coe. Besides the federal program, a state bill that calls for mediation before a foreclosure was recently approved by the Oregon House. According to Coe, it's part of the same Band-Aid approach. Homeowners facing foreclosure eviction can access the grassroots network of supporters at the website housingisforeveryone.org.
This week, former Troutdale principal Jeff Gilbert agreed to repay the $17,000 he allegedly stole from the Reynolds High School Associated Student Body Fund. Susan Nisbet, a private investigator the Reynolds School District hired to investigate the case, found that Gilbert was reimbursed for 21 personal expenses, including furniture, home entertainment gear, and the vintage arcade game Asteroids. According to the Oregonian, Gilbert was put on probation in January 2012 and fired 6 months later. In addition to district concerns about financial impropriety, Gilbert's administrator license lapsed in 2011. Gilbert unsuccessfully challenged his termination to the school and the Oregon Fair Dismissals Appeal Boards. A Multnomah County prosecutor told Gilbert's attorney they were ready to seek an indictment based on the private investigator's evidence 9 days ago. The civil compromise Gilbert's attorney reached with the school district are believed to head off additional legal action. In exchange for repayment of the stolen student fees, Gilbert has agreed not to appeal his case to the Oregon Fair Dismissals Appeal Board or to sue the school district for wrongful termination. Gilbert has since left the education field.
Eagle Point School District in Southern Oregon is considering arming its teachers to protect students from school violence. Recently elected school board president Scott Grissom said at a board meeting on Wednesday that he was very committed to the idea. Under the policy, certain faculty members would be allowed to possess firearms on school property. Those employees would be given firearms training, liability insurance, and extra pay. Board Vice President Ted Dole asked that the motion be tabled until a committee could be formed to examine the proposal. The school board approved the policy 4-1 after Board President Grissom directed the school superintendent to form such a committee. Departing board member Jim Mannenbach, a retired teacher, was the lone dissenting vote. Mannenbach has had a contentious relationship with fellow board members who have censured him at least twice for working too closely with the teachers' union. During the meeting, he urged the school district to keep guns out of the school and instead pursue federal grants to improve security.
This week, Oregon law enforcement agencies around the state successfully lobbied Salem to expand red light camera usage. House Bill 2601 easily passed both chambers. Oregon's legislative director with the American Civil Liberties Union, Becky Strauss, spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan about the implications of how police may use the technology following new rule changes.
The aim of these bills was to expand the use of the footage from the cameras so that it would repeal what was in existing law at the time, which said that the red light camera footage could only be used for tickets for people violating, running through a red light, essentially. And so what this bill did and what the legislature approved was an expansion on the use of the footage so that they could be used in other criminal proceedings. So, for example, someone is fleeing the scene of a crime and drives through a red light in the process, that footage can then be used to place the offender in the time and place as they cross the red light. So the legislature approved their expanded use, and they'll now be able to use for more criminal uses.
And how does the ACLU feel about this?
Ultimately, on this bill in particular, we came to a position of what I sort of began to describe as uncomfortably neutral. I think that this use in some ways has some legitimate function, and we took comfort in the idea that the footage is not streaming the intersection all the time. The footage is only captured when someone crosses through a red light, so that in of itself narrows the universe of the footage that's captured. That said, the uncomfortable part comes from this idea that the legislature authorizes the use of new technology, in this case surveillance technology in some ways, with limitations, put some sidebars on how it will be used going forward. And the concern that we have is that we come back each session, as we did with House Bill 2601, and begin to chip away at the initial protections that the legislature put in. So there was in the law, about before this session started, a requirement that the footage from red light cameras only be used for red light tickets. And now we've expanded beyond that use. And so we just asked the legislature to think about what kind of expansion is really necessary and at what cost to privacy rights.
What about the vendors? What do we know about them, and how much are they making from the revenue generated?
I think those are absolutely appropriate questions to ask. In some ways, the public doesn't know enough about, first of all, what types of cameras are posted around our cities, but secondly, where is the money going? I think a lot of the vendors do set up these cameras, and they provide a great revenue stream for themselves, as opposed to having some of the money make it worthwhile for the municipality to be using the cameras. Those are questions that we should be asking more of our local officials and our local law enforcement agencies to track where that money is going. Some of this has been a concern for the ACLU in that a lot of the work or the decision-making from our local law enforcement agencies does not happen in the public eye. We see things come up to city council very often where we were not aware that the Portland Police Bureau was utilizing the number of surveillance cameras, for example, that they have been utilizing, or utilizing the number of license plate readers, as another example, that they had been utilizing. And we've pushed the city council to make that a much more transparent process. Ideally, we would like to see the Bureau come to city council for approval to use these types of technologies so that we can have a public detailed conversation about what technology they're using, where they're using it, and what their policy is for things like sharing the data once they've captured it or destroying the data when it's no longer used.
That was Becky Strauss, Oregon's legislative director with the American Civil Liberties Union, speaking with KBOO's Robin Ryan.
A coalition of local groups are organizing a caravan to the state capitol this Tuesday to testify in support of a Senate bill that would try to end racial and ethnic profiling in the state. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Andrew Riley from the Center for Intercultural Organizing.
I wonder if you can tell us about the Senate Bill 560, which is coming up next week.
Yeah, Senate Bill 560 is a piece of legislation that we are calling the End Profiling Act. And it's modeled off of a very successful law from New Mexico. And what it does is defines and bans profiling, and profiling on a very broad, in a very broad sense. It covers age, race, ethnicity, color, national origin, language, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, political affiliation, homelessness, and a few other categories of folks. And it creates a streamlined complaint procedure for folks who have been profiled to really get some justice. And it also creates a training requirement that every 2 years departments train their officers on how not to profile.
Is that review process outside of the existing citizen review process that a number of people who have been profiled have complained about?
It is. So the process that's created would be a statewide streamlined complaint procedure where folks could file a complaint with the state attorney general's office, who would have the authority to investigate any complaints or profiling in any police department across the state. So it would be entirely outside of the existing independent police review and citizen review committee process.
Now, this bill was introduced in February, hasn't really moved anywhere in the legislature since then. Do you think there's still a chance that it can get through in these last 2 weeks of this session?
You know, we don't anticipate that, no. The bill has missed a couple of deadlines to move forward, and so the hearing that we have next Tuesday is really just an informational hearing to open a conversation about profiling with legislators so that we can move this bill in a future legislative session, either 2014 or 2015.
And at Tuesday's hearing, what do you hope to accomplish?
I really want to start a conversation about profiling in the Oregon legislature. It's not a conversation that I think a lot of elected officials have had, and it's not an issue that's on a lot of folks' radar. So really what we're hoping is to have folks come out to share their experiences with profiling, how it's impacted them, their families, their communities, to really make the case for taking bold action to stop profiling. You know, we don't think that this law itself ends profiling, but it does give our communities some pretty powerful accountability tools when profiling does happen. So the first step to that is, I think, having folks share their personal experiences with profiling and how it's impacted them.
If people want to get involved or maybe testify, how would they do that?
You know, we're going to have some vans leaving from the CIO office at 11:30 on Tuesday morning, and we're going to be taking folks down to Salem with us. And so if folks are interested in getting involved, I encourage you to take a look at our website, take a look at our Facebook page. We have a registration link. We're hoping to get a sense of how many people might join us. But anyone and everyone is welcome to come down and join us for this event.
And again, that website for the Center for Intercultural Organizing is interculturalorganizing.org. I've been speaking with Andrew Riley, who works with the Center for Intercultural Organizing here in Portland. Thanks for joining us, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. We'll be joined by the women behind the Concertina Wire, a weekly radio program on KWVA Eugene, highlighting the written work of incarcerated individuals. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is mostly cloudy with temperatures in the high 70s through the weekend.
It's 5:24, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Let the church bells peal somberly, for we progressives have suffered an unexpected and tragic loss that leaves an awful void in our movement. I speak, of course, about the recent passing from America's political scene of a lady who truly was a shooting star, Michelle Bachmann. So perkily quirky, so ridiculously right-wing, so piously hypocritical, so incoherently pontifical, the Minnesota Congresswoman, Tea Party sparkly and flash-in-the-pan presidential pretender, was a gusher of good news for the progressive cause every time she opened her mouth. Alas, though, faced with likely defeat in her own district next year and an ethical mess involving her campaign finances, Bachmann has announced she'll not run again, prompting a nationwide pity party among progressives. Even in her passing, however, she left us with some typical Bachmann bon mots, including this promise: I will continue to work vehemently and robustly to fight back against what most Democrats want to do, to transform our country into becoming. Yes, stop America from becoming is her battle cry, which I think means she's robustly against the future and will vehemently fight to stop it. The good news for progressives is that as Michelle fades into the past, several new Tea Party popinjays in Congress have emerged as top contenders for Bachmann's silver-tongued babbler crown. One has spurted to an early lead, Representative Steve Stockman of Texas. He warns that sex education classes are teaching bestiality to school kids and insists that, quote, the best thing about Earth is if you poke holes in it, oil and gas come out. Oh, Steve also asserts that if babies had guns, they wouldn't be aborted. This is Jim Hightower saying, now that is deeply Bachmann-esque. So take heart, progressives. Michelle may be dearly departed, but her spirit will still be with us.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Lawmakers in Arizona have approved the Medicaid expansion offered by the Affordable Care Act. The state will receive more than $1.5 billion to expand coverage to 250,000 uninsured Arizonans. Although a fierce critic of Obamacare, Republican Governor Jan Brewer came out in support of the Medicaid expansion earlier this year. In a statement, Brewer applauded those who voted for the expansion, praising their courage and conviction, saying they put the people of the state first. Arizona joins 20 other states and Washington, D.C. in approving Medicaid expansion. Lawmakers in New Hampshire, Indiana, Tennessee, Maine, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Ohio are still debating the Medicaid provision. According to the Commonwealth Fund, the states that have declined the federal health care expansion have among the lowest rated health systems, some of the highest rates of uninsured adults, and some of the lowest health care equity across race.
Today, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the annual defense bill, which includes tougher punishment for military personnel convicted of rape and sexual assault, but also prevents the closure of Guantanamo prison and increases funding for weapons and bases that military commanders say they do not need. The $638 billion package is an annual measure which authorizes the military funding for equipment and personnel. Included in the bill were provisions meant to tackle the military's growing rape crisis, with over 26,000 service members reporting a sexual assault last year. The new House bill would require a minimum 2-year prison sentence and dishonorable discharge for those convicted of sex crimes. The bill would also bar commanders from overturning rape and sexual assault charges, which military regulations currently allow. The House defense measure must be aligned with the Senate's version, which will be considered in the fall. While President Obama supports the rape victim protection clauses, he's threatening to veto the bill if it passes the Senate because of a provision blocking the closure of Guantanamo Bay.
In a teleconference with Oregon media last night, Senator Ron Wyden accused the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, of contradicting himself in past statements about the spying on Americans carried out by the National Security Agency. Wyden promised to continue to pressure Clapper and other intelligence officials to publicly explain what the rules are for turning American cell phones into tracking devices, but he did not go so far as to call for Clapper's resignation. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin last night, supporters of former Senator Russ Feingold gathered to rally around the only U.S. senator who voted against the U.S. Patriot Act that established the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. In a statement on the Senate floor in 2008, Feingold argued that the act gave too much power to the executive branch, undermining both the U.S. Congress and the Constitution.
In 2006, when the Republicans tried to push through legislation to grant massive new surveillance authority to the executive branch, we stopped it. But now, in a Democrat-controlled Congress, not only did we pass the Protect America Act, but we're now about to extend for more than 4 years these expansive surveillance powers, and we're about to grant immunity to companies that are alleged to have participated in the administration's lawlessness. Mr. President, I sit on the Intelligence and Judiciary Committees, and I'm one of the few members of this body who has been fully briefed on the warrantless wiretapping program. And based on what I know, I can promise that if more information is declassified about the program in the future, as is likely to happen, either due to the Inspector General report, the election of a new president, or simply the passage of time, members of this body will regret that we passed this legislation. I'm also familiar with the collection activities that have been conducted under the Protect America Act and will continue under this bill. I invite any of my colleagues who wish to know more about these activities to come speak to me in a classified setting. Publicly, all I can say is that I have serious concerns about how those activities may have impacted the civil liberties of all Americans. If we grant these new powers to the governments and the effects become known to the American people, we will realize what a mistake it was. Of that, I am sure. So, Mr. President, I hope my colleagues will think long and hard about their votes in this bill and consider how they and their constituents will feel about this vote 5, 10, or 20 years from now. I'm confident that history will not judge this Senate kindly if it endorses this tragic retreat from the principles that have governed government conduct in this sensitive area for 30 years.
That was Senator Russ Feingold speaking in 2008 about his concerns with the potential overreach of government through warrantless wiretapping. Feingold was defeated by Tea Party Republican Senator Ron Johnson in 2010. In his rally last night, Feingold hinted that he may be willing to run again to regain his congressional seat in 2016.
Today marks 128 days of a hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay prison camp.